Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. Now, to our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. And as a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter to you most. Now, I want you to think about today's security dynamics. Vladimir Putin may invade Ukraine, the threat environment is scaling off the charts in the Pacific thanks to China, and it doesn't stop there with the US still juggling challenges like the Middle East and protecting the homeland. Now, air power is a key resource required to successfully operate in each one of these regions, but forces are stretched too thin to meet real-world demand. And let's be honest, if things escalated in Ukraine and the US Air Force is asked to engage, we'd be stretched thin. And it gets even worse if demand escalates elsewhere. 185 F-22s translate to about 100 able to deploy at any given time. Once in theater, these operate in cycles, so you've got some on station, some coming home, and some getting ready to launch. Do that math and add in some downtime for maintenance, and you're looking at 30 jets in the air at any given moment, across a large region. Now, that's the entire F-22 fleet. We can turn to the F-35, but we've only got about 300 of those given that it's still in production and we're building towards top-line capacity goals. I haven't even begun to talk about meeting demands in the Pacific, the Middle East, or defending the homeland. It doesn't take a genius to realize that the force is too small given today's security demands. Sure, we wish things were calmer, but our adversaries hold that card. And the smaller our forces get, the more we incentivize aggression because our opponents think they've got a shot at getting away with it. We can't be in two places at once, so it's really solid odds that we won't have enough aircraft to respond. We often hear this sort of situation as unprecedented, and yeah, in some ways it is, but in other ways it simply isn't. We're going to talk about one example that aligns really closely with the dynamics we're seeing today, the air war over Korea, and what it means given current challenges. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mitchell's Executive Director, Doug Berkey, who just released a report on this topic.
Slick, thanks for having me, and you're right. Too often we look at challenges in front of us and we think we've never had it so bad. But the reality is that if you look at the history that we've been through, and especially in recent decades, there's been a lot that we've confronted, really challenging situations. And look, it's not always going to match up 100%, but it's often close enough to really offer some useful perspectives. And that's why I really wrote this report. I knew about Korea from the general sense, stuff like MiG-Ali, B-29 raids, carriers launching aircraft to go do strike missions. But I really didn't know a lot of the details regarding kind of the operational and strategic factors that were in play and leadership considerations. And, I got to be honest, it's hard to find the resources on this. I've known forever that there's an official Air Force history on this, but it's bigger than a brick, literally. Very detailed and all that, good resource. I used it for this report, but for casual reading, come on. And there's some other books out there, but they're really tactical, put you in the cockpit over MiG-Ali from the perspective of a captain or a lieutenant. And look, man, I love those too, but they're more adventure stories than they are really air power analysis pieces. So
sure.
No, totally. So I wanted to do a piece that was actually going to look at the drivers that were driving decisions back then. And it's stuff we talk about all the time here on the podcast. And it's really what's driving the thinking that's manifesting actions at the operational and tactical levels. And so, political pressures, inter-service challenges, the threat, budget realities, operational demands, you get the mix.
Yeah, sure. So with all of that, Doug, set the scene for us. I mean, this is 5 years right after World War II, right? And we're at the front end of the Cold War, but we still have a pretty big Air Force at that time, right?
Well, this thing kicked off and nobody thought it was going to happen. It was an absolute surprise. The North Korean forces went over the 38th parallel at 4 a.m. on July 25th, 1950. And just to be clear, the 38th parallel was pretty much a new division between the two countries that were, in fact, new countries based on the results of the war. It was chosen arbitrarily by some very junior staffers at State Department at the end of World War II. The only reason why there was a communist section of Korea was it was an offering to the Soviet Union for coming in the Pacific at the tail end of the war. And so this is all really, really new stuff in many ways. And in fact, we had even considered not including South Korea in a kind of our zones of interest, where we would draw red lines around the world with the opening of the Cold War. So North Korean forces come surging across the 38th parallel, and it's brutal. I mean, South Korean forces are streaming back. It's very ugly. And in fact, we had purposely kept them weak. In the ironic factor here is that we thought they were going to invade the North, and we didn't want them to be armed to go do that. So these guys are not set up to fight. And we had pulled the last of our forces out of the country by the time this had happened. There's a very small-scale presence there, mainly embassy kind of folks and all that. And so it took time to figure out what was going on. I mean, remember, this is before the era of incredible situational awareness of space assets or U-2s or all of that. You know, you don't have people everywhere with cell phones or smartphones telling you what's going on. And we didn't really have many forces in theater. So we're trying to figure out what's happening. But it rapidly becomes clear that there's a disaster afoot here. And it's clearly going to be one of the first fights of the Cold War. And to answer your initial question here, no. The U.S. military and the Air Force in particular, they've been gutted after World War II, and they were in no condition to respond to this challenge.
Well, Doug, you got to dive in a little deeper. What do you mean? This is honestly the first time I've really heard it described that way. How bad are we talking?
Okay, you're not going to really believe this. I double-checked it when I ran across this in my research. In 1950, and again, you're thinking front end of the Cold War, we've got to be super strong. No. The Air Force was 18% of its peak World War II strength. So the U.S. had literally deconstructed the air power that won World War II, and they did it with an axe and a wood chipper. Aircraft were scrapped at record rates. Their spares are destroyed. Pilots and experienced maintainers, they're out. Support equipment was tossed. It was all gone.
Were the airlines hiring at that point, Doug? I just have to ask that question.
Yeah, that was part. No, serious, man. It was part of it. There was huge expansion going on. And these people went back to their civil lives. I mean, you got to remember, they're kids, predominantly late teens, early 20s that fought World War II. They're getting on with it. A lot of these people were doing the GI Bill track, creating new careers. And so you had theoretical potential you could reactivate to bring them in, but it wasn't very accessible. So if we look at what was actually in theater, Slick, I mean, this was really, really rough. There were only 657 aircraft, and almost all of them were obsolete. I'm talking about types like the B-29, B-26 Invader, C-54, C-47, F-82 Twin Mustang, and P-51s. And the readiness rates were in the toilet. And to make it even worse, I mean, you think about a rapid response here and all that. We lack surge capacity. Sure, theoretically, there were types like the F-86 and the F-84, the brand new jet fighters, but those are incredibly new at the time, and their lines weren't scaled for mass build rates. They were in austere times, and so they really hadn't created them to chunk out dozens a month or anything like that. And sure, look, we had some Gen 1 F-80s, very early jet fighters, but the budgets had been so tight in the late 40s that they hadn't been modernized consistently. And so you really kind of had a cats and dogs inventory of capability blocks. And so you're trying to get airframes out to units that can actually be sustained and operated intelligently, didn't exist. And the industrial base and depot consolidation was so aggressive during the era then that we really didn't have the facilities or the talent to process those to get them all upline for combat. So here's an example. The commanders in Korea wanted 325 F-80s as soon as possible, but the modernization pipeline could only process 27 jets per month. That's 3 years just to work through that little backlog.
Wow.
That's crazy. So it got so bad that the commanders in the Pacific were actually requesting World War II era P-47s. And DOD considered it briefly, but it turns out there weren't enough spares in the inventory to sustain those in combat. So you couldn't even have that. So the fallback was raid guard units for old P-51s, pull B-29s out of the desert, reactivate those. I mean, they were absolutely desperate. And the same for personnel. You know, they did pull some in from the guard and the reserve and all that, but you had to train a lot of kids from scratch. And it wasn't just air crews. I mean, ground crews were in such short supply. I was reading one account where a B-29 air crew, after they had flown combat missions, which lasted several hours, they had to fuel their own planes, load the bombs for the next day, and a bunch of other duties. I mean, this is a really thin force, and it was far from healthy.
Yeah, and Doug, I can't help but in your remarks there drawing the parallels to today with older generation aircraft, and then, yeah, we have new stuff just coming on the line, but not enough to sustain a future fight. So, but yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk about that later. What I want to do is hop into in your research there, what the early missions were like.
Yeah, not totally, man. They're ad hoc, to say the least. I mean, in the early days, it was all about stopping the retreat. This meant flowing a lot of supplies into theater, you know, both people and equipment. It also meant a lot of close air support, bombing enemy supply lines. And we also had to focus on air superiority because the North Koreans did have an air force, and they were attacking our forces a lot. In fact, they destroyed several C-54s that were offloading equipment. So when we talk about things like the need for air superiority or air-based defense, it's very much alive back in that theater.
Yeah, sure. What are some of the other challenges?
Okay, man, get a chair here. This is going to take a little bit to get through. It's a very long list. First, range and base access. Korea had very few airfields, and the ones that existed were almost entirely built by the Japanese in World War II, and their dirt and grass facilities. They couldn't accommodate jets without major rework, and even World War II types like the P-51 were taking a lot of risk to use them. There were zero support facilities or hangars for the most part, which meant maintenance was brutal. You saw mission capable rates drop to incredibly low levels, which means it cuts your combat capacity dramatically. And just the overarching infrastructure to support ops. I mean, consider this. The 51st Fighter Group at Kimpo required 60,000 gallons of fuel a day to fly missions. Now, you think about delivering that where you don't have pipelines. You really don't have good highways or roads to deliver that kind of stuff, even tanker trucks in theater. I mean, this is really tough. And the maintainers didn't even unpack the gear that was sent over because there was nowhere to put it. And if you take it out of the crate, it's going to get rained on or wrecked in the mud. So these guys just focused on laying down the steel mat runways and ramp areas and doing their best. But the high use rates, carrying combat loads and all that, tore that stuff up pretty fast. So you'd actually have to take an entire airbase and take it offline for a period and reconstruct it. And this kept happening again and again and again. So it meant the majority of the aircraft for a distinct period of time had to rely on bases in Japan. But remember, aerial refueling didn't really exist at an operational level at that point. So this really cut down on their time on station for combat sorties. So just consider this. F-80s flying out of Japan spent about 85% of their sortie duration length actually in transit from Japan to the peninsula and back. That left them with about 15 minutes of actual combat time over the peninsula. And so that is really undermining the utility of what's already a really small force. And then even when the jets could operate from Korea, range is still a problem. I mean, these early jets were very fuel thirsty and not efficient at all. So F-86s flying up to the border with China, traditional MiG alley, would only be able to stay on station about 25 minutes. I know I said it before, but there's also the lack of aircraft and personnel. The attrition rates were so bad that the Air Force really couldn't stay up with backfilling aircraft and people. So here's an example. During one period of the war, the Air Force was losing 93 B-26 crews a month. Now, the training pipeline could only generate 58 crews a month. And the B-26 hadn't been built in years, so the Air Force, you know, they couldn't tap a hot production line or anything to backfill aircraft. So they were scrambling to grab aircraft anywhere they could. And kind of like that F-80 example earlier on, it talked about they were all random models. Almost none of them were combat capable. This left the maintenance crews trying to do the upgrades in theater in these conditions I described. It's an absolute disaster, but it represents a death spiral of combat capability and capacity. And I could talk about this for any other mission type. I mean, in 1952, the U.S. lost 243 aircraft in April. It had another 290 damaged, and they only got 131 replacements. Again, death spiral.
That's in 1 month, Doug? Those numbers are for 1 month?
Yeah, and that's a small war. I mean, Korea is not a war, you know, mainline Europe against Soviet Union. This is a proxy war. And so commanders had to revert to flying combat sorties based on what they could sustain from an attrition perspective, not what the actual requirements demanded. And I really want to emphasize this. Fighting to stay alive is fundamentally different than fighting to win. It is very, very dangerous. because it gives the enemy the initiative, it gives them the time advantage, the decision advantage of how and when they want to employ forces, and it really is going to put you in a bad attrition spot. And so very, very dangerous. And like I said, proxy war here. This is not the mainline conflict. You know, and we look at the overarching enterprise. I mean, spare parts flows are so bad that in 1952, in January, F-86 mission capable rates hit 45%. So you're taking an already small force and cutting it in half. This is nuts. It's not just the aircraft and the mainline systems you think about. It's the entire support enterprise. I mean, you know, you've talked about those beat up runways. Well, we had gotten rid of so much of the construction equipment at the end of World War II that the engineers used, that what remained was beat up and oversubscribed. And the availability for that support equipment was down to around 15% in the middle of the war. So it compounds in every different angle. It's really frustrating for all these guys.
Yeah, well, Doug, and I know that there's got to be more based on the research that you've done. So what was going on with the enemy and everything else at this time?
Yeah, there was a huge technology race at this point with the Soviet Union. So we began the war with World War II equipment, but it rapidly transitioned to combat jets that were cutting edge for the time. So MiG-15s show up in the fall of 1950, and from that point in time, we are constantly hanging on by our fingernails to maintain air superiority. And the problem was, look, the F-86 is roughly comparable to a MiG-15, but the production rates were slow to expand because, again, we had run the lines way too thin and how we had built the industrial base for that. And this is hugely, hugely important because it mirrors today. We had concurrent demands in Europe because you couldn't take your eye off the mainline Soviet threat there. And then, of course, homeland defense, because we're worried about the bomber threat from the Soviet Union coming over. So you were concurrently managing risk between Europe, homeland, and Korea. Nobody's getting enough in any category there. And so very thin numbers. And this is how bad it got. In September 1951, we had 90 F-86s in theater facing over 500 MiG-15s. And remember that mission capability rate I cited where it was about, you know, 45% at certain windows. So this is really, really challenging to project power that could actually be decisive. And because the runways are too beat up oftentimes for the jets to use in the peninsula, you know, we're doing these ferry missions from Japan. You know, it was just very, very difficult. And so it meant you couldn't dominate and have uniform air superiority. You could only open up windows of air superiority for very defined periods of time to get assets in or out, you know, for bombing mission or reconnaissance mission or whatever you wanted, and then you'd have to exit. And so this is very, very difficult for us. And in fact, vast sections of the northern part of the peninsula were off limits to us throughout the war, and people forget that. We kind of have this hubris as we're the United States, we go anywhere, anytime. Yeah, not back then. And then it goes on. If I look at training, you know, I told you we got rid of all these combat capable crews at the end of World War II. And so very thin force. And the guys that we did retain, they weren't keeping their combat qualifications up to speed. You know, as you know better than anybody, Slick, landing currency is not the same as your combat qualifications. So we were pulling guys out of stateside assignments, throwing them into the fight in Korea with really, really limited training. And they were learning on the job, and a lot of them paid with their lives. And it actually got so bad that certain mission areas, like fighter aviation, for example, were getting so thin that we were having to raid other mission areas like airlift and put cargo pilots in jet fighter cockpits. And no disrespect to airlift pilots, but flying close to the speed of sound at that time in a highly maneuverable fighter in a very challenging mission domain is a lot different. And you can bridge to that, but it takes a ton of training. You know, Slick, you know this, you lived it.
Oh, absolutely. And to your point there, it's not a hit on the pilots themselves. It's just you have to have the opportunity to train to those skills, and you're just doing those airmen a disservice to, you know, it'd be like putting me into a cargo airplane and asking me to land, something heavy. I mean, it just, I would need the training to do it properly. But I do want to ask you this because of the time that we are at then is what kind of war are we being asked to fight? I mean, clearly North Korea was being sustained and empowered by the Soviet Union and China, but we couldn't attack those countries without risking World War III. So can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, you bet. It really meant that we couldn't go after enemy centers of gravity. And that's an advantage we had in World War II. I mean, you could go to the heart of Germany or Japan and really go after the centers that were producing the key war materiel, command and control centers, logistics hubs, you name it. You go take them out and have hugely disproportionately effective results for us. But because we, like you said, we didn't want to start World War III, we could only interdict the supply lines that were coming into North Korea. And it got so ridiculous that, you know, people have heard these things. You could only bomb one half of the bridge going across the Yalu River from China to North Korea because we're worried about upsetting the Chinese. Well, you know, good luck with that with a B-29 from 30,000 feet with stiff winds and the enemy shooting at you. And so they flow supplies down in a number of ways, but they're all pretty primitive. You know, you've got trucks driving on unimproved roads. You've got humans carrying things. And then you got some limited rail lines. Sure, when we can find those things, we'll attack them. But again, remember, this is not ubiquitous space surveillance and everything else feeding data for very good, tight command and control decision-making on how to employ the assets here. You're running across stuff as best you can. Well, we got good enough at it where they switched to doing everything at night because their losses were too large during daytime. Well, that really made it tough for us. We would try our best, but it was very difficult to go after that. When we were successful, the challenge is because their transport means are so primitive, they had huge labor advantages on their side. Unskilled laborers can repair a road really fast or reset a rail line. Again, it's just how do you keep up with this? One commander described it like trying to dam a waterfall at the bottom, you know, with the cork. It's obviously impossible. And if you talk about also understanding what we did and how we then would guide our actions because of it, these guys are in the blind. They're, in 1953, it's a very illustrative example here, a B-26. They reported they had destroyed six trucks at night. And it turns out they mistakenly attacked South Korean group of soldiers. They killed four of them, sadly. And the only damage that really happened to the vehicles, they punctured two truck tires. And it was night. They couldn't see. You know, I don't think these guys are trying to lie. It was just a very difficult set of circumstances. And so credit to the guys. They did cut a vast majority of the logistics lines. And while they didn't totally cut the flow, they did constrain it substantially. And that's a huge reason why the fighting stalemated at the 38th parallel again. But a huge factor, and we saw this again in Vietnam, is the average communist soldier only required about a tenth of the supplies of a standard U.S. or South Korean soldier or another United Nations soldier. So they really could survive on a trickle.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate this. It makes me wonder what's going on with the other services and how things are on the joint side of the equation. You know, was air power well integrated with the other elements of air power from the other services?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you it was, but quite the opposite. And this one's really important because we've seen similar problems in recent years, especially over the last 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, where a lot of the command structures were not joint. They're very service dominated. So let me kind of paint a picture here for you. The command structure was built with the commander of the United Nations forces in Korea, dual-hatted as a commander-in-chief of U.S. Far East forces. General MacArthur was that leader for the beginning of the war. He then, and this happened very similarly in Afghanistan and Iraq, triple-hatted himself as commander of U.S. Army forces in the Far East. Well, that leaves the commanders of Naval Forces Far East and Air Forces Far East pretty far down the command ladder. And if this wasn't bad enough, MacArthur staffed his headquarters with Army officers almost entirely. So there really wasn't any Air Force, Navy, or Marine representation. So that leads you to a very one-sided assessment of the issues and how you're going to make leadership decision calls. And so it predominantly saw air power directed for close air support missions at times when it should have been focused elsewhere. And just technically speaking, Army leaders were asking airmen to do things that were unwise or oftentimes fought with the laws of physics. It was very, very frustrating here. And they also wanted air power assigned organically. And as we all know, it's one of the biggest lessons from World War II is you can't do it that way. It is too inefficient. Air power can cover hundreds of miles on a sortie You cannot just restrict it to a very small area. We don't have enough of it to do that. And so very, very difficult times. On top of this, Navy and Air Force leaders weren't communicating very well. This led to naval aircraft and Air Force aircraft at the beginning of the war flying completely uncoordinated missions, doing their own thing respectively, left huge gaps. Sometimes it saw us doubling up when we shouldn't have been. It got so bad that it finally just forced cooperation, and it led to the creation, effectively, they didn't call it this back then, but, you know, Combined Forces Air Component Commander, the CFAC. And that was the Far East Air Force's commander that was granted that coordinating authority. Things really didn't get better until General Mark Clark arrived in 1952 on the joint side. And to his credit, he insisted the headquarters staff had to really become joint. And this is absolutely crucial from an air perspective, because at that time, we were stalemated at the 38th parallel again. So air power is actually the only tool you had left. I mean, the ground forces were pretty much in static lines, and it had to be directed competently.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible, Doug. And if it was this bad, how did the air leaders get anything done?
Well, it's really simple. These guys fought for what was right. And this is hard stuff, Slick. I mean, these guys put their careers on the line. It took a toll on them. I mean, a lot of people don't notice, but one of the first Far East Air Force commanders, General Stratemeyer, he rotated out after having a heart attack. I mean, these guys had a lot of stress on them, but they had the convictions of what was right, and they fought for it and for what was the best use of air power, not just to save airmen's lives, but the joint force. And I'll be direct. These air commanders were heroes. We don't appreciate them enough. We should celebrate their example. They should be taught what real leadership is. And I don't think that happens. And I think it's a travesty. And we are losing too many battles in the near term because we're not enforcing that kind of legacy in as a model.
Yeah, well, I hate to say it, Doug, but I don't think times have really changed. I mean, look at how the Army domination is these days with the SecDef chairman, a number of the key COCOMs, and so many more. And it's, you know, really led to an incredibly unjoint, ground-centric thinking that we've incorporated over the last two decades in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obviously, seeing that, how that worked out, I mean, even to the point with the Air Force, I mean, their biggest commercials were ground force airmen shooting guns, not flying airplanes. But you know, we know the Air Force has never had a rotation as head of PACOM, the theater dominated by air, not just water, and tossing support for space leaders, too. I mean, we're at a key juncture here. They need to be at the forefront when their skills represent the preponderance of the force that's going to be used. And to that point, we look who's in charge of Space Command, the Army, right? I mean, it's not a member of the Space Force. And I'm sorry, I hate to vent here, but it's just one of those things that blows my mind. I think it's got to change.
Nah, I totally agree, Slick. And the question is, who's carrying that message these days? You know, I certainly don't hear it very often. And I agree with you. One would think losing two wars in slow motion over 20 years would call for some reflection here. But, you know, I guess let's get back to Korea here.
Well, you know, actually, let's bring it to the current day. So what does this all really mean for our Air Force and Space Force today?
Yeah. Well, from a resource perspective, the parallels are disturbingly similar. I mean, you hit it pretty hard at the opening, but we all know, we talk about it all the time here, we don't have enough of the modern assets. Back in the day, there were F-86s and F-84s. Today, it's fifth-gen fighters, stealth bombers, airlifters, search and rescue, ISR types, C-2 aircraft, electronic warfare systems. We just don't have enough in any category. I mean, we can barely meet the demands for a smaller contingency, and we'd be a breaking point for a major war, especially one that lasts a long time. You know, we see these attrition rates from Korea. Not going to be much different today, probably worse. And there's no way that we could handle two high-end wars at the same time. And our enemies know that. They'll take advantage of it. And you know, Slick, you can't tell me China isn't watching our response to Ukraine very carefully right now.
Of course.
You know, and we don't have enough people. I mean, let's consider the fact that we've had an extended pilot and maintainer crisis for several years now. And this is during peacetime. There's no way that we have the capacity to backfill combat attrition in key personnel areas. We took away the ability to surge production of those folks for a budget efficiency after the Cold War. We've never regained it. And you know this, man, this is your life. You cannot surge that stuff. You have to experience people over time. And this is not flip of the switch kind of stuff to regain it when you need it. They experienced it back then with far simpler systems. You look at where we are now with technological sophistication and complexity, and it's just so much harder. It's the same for production lines of aircraft, munitions, support systems. I mean, there's just no way we can surge to meet wartime demands. And we've also taken risks with our spares inventories for budget savings. So we can't even fall back on that. So, you know, I just look at the whole picture. I mean, heck, you look at the flying hours guys are getting these days. It's not enough. The numbers are way down. We always used to pride ourselves that, well, we might be, you know, smaller than the enemy, but we're better. We're getting all these hours. Look at us. We're great. It's not the case anymore. Oftentimes, when you look at the numbers, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the numbers from a flying hours perspective is a direct reflection. I mean, in the squadron, you know, when I was a captain, we would laugh at the North Korean pilot training program, and not just from like getting their wings, but what they did on a daily basis flying, because they flew maybe like 100, 150 hours a year at best. And we were averaging, you know, 330. And now our pilots are where the North Koreans were back when I was flying. But, and I don't mean it, you know, from a historical perspective, but it's just things have really changed. But what about logistics and basing? I mean, that's something that has to be a key element in all this as well.
Oh man, you bet. It's everything. You know, people forget it's the glue that holds the entire force together. So you look at the limited number of air bases we have in the Pacific and our ability to defend them. I mean, it's a huge vulnerability. There just aren't many. And we lack enough airlifters, especially when you consider that the civilian providers, you know, the civilian air reserve fleet craft that we've relied on for the last 20 years, they're not going to fly into harm's way with civilian crews in combat zones. And so that means we are leveraging a huge percentage of the demand on the combat airlift crews, and they have to handle the spikes in demand. And when we look at distributed operations, that's what the Agile Combat Employment, ACE, is all about. Let's use outlying fields so we don't have a center of gravity ourselves with a mega base like Guam, you know, Anderson, something like that. Well, that takes that much more logistics to sustain. I mean, you try to maintain a group F-22s flying combat missions, you're going to have to chalk some C-17s to them pretty much organically just to keep the munitions, the spare parts, all the rest of it flowing. And so we just don't have enough. And, you know, remember, the C-17 line closed over a decade ago. We can't hit a switch and get that back. And so we can't backfill for combat attrition with them or just the raw demand, like I said. And we've also aligned our spare parts system way too tightly around a centralized depot kind of model in just-in-time spares and other measures that make sense if you're a civilian business, but they're not viable for combat. And given how small the Air Force inventory is, the fact that logistics supply lines are going to be hard-pressed to function, it's just going to erode aircraft availability rates. I mean, those F-86s were down not because the jets, you know, were inherently bad or broken or whatever. It's just they couldn't get the spares and the qualified maintenance folks to them. So it's not good. It's going to be worse. Things are way more complex now, so it's just harder.
Well, sure. And Doug, can you talk about the limited war variables that we saw in Korea?
Yeah, no, I think this is a big deal. I think that if we look at the current construct in play, obviously we have to prepare to fight China or Russia directly. It's a pacing threat. It's crucial. And you're not going to have credible deterrence unless you're able to do that. However, as we're seeing with discussions with Ukraine, what they're doing in Russia, nobody is excited to go fight another peer. And so I think the same is going to hold true for China, and it's going to increase the likelihood that we'll probably fight proxy wars, much like we saw during the Cold War. That means we're going to be back to this zone of not being able to strike centers of gravity that would make most sense. And so we're going to be back to hitting supply lines, forward bases, supply depots, fielded forces, which, like I described, that's really hard. It's going to demand really high fidelity, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, command and control, and precision strike. And it's why Joint All-Domain Command and Control, JADC2, it's so important. Obviously, it's important on high-end war, but it's also going to be really important in these other operations that could occur. You know, it's all about understanding how to get your best result under dynamic conditions, using our forces smartly, you know, knowing that we don't have many, and avoiding threats so we're not flying into harm's way and we don't have to.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Doug. And I know we're getting a little long on time, and we sort of danced around this a little bit, but what do you think the lessons are for today's leaders?
Well, first, we really can't ignore the importance of joint leadership. One service shouldn't dominate. The lead should go to whomever is providing the preponderance of forces. And then, you know, you still want diversity at the staff level. You do want every service represented so that you have their expertise and they're all improving the game. And like I don't think Slick, you would suggest that you know how to command a submarine very well. And obviously you want the sub driver there to provide that expertise. You know, same, he shouldn't be speaking for you as an F-16 pilot. And so if that makes sense kind of at the tactical operational level, then why are we confusing these lines at the strategic command level? It's very disturbing. And then second, I think we need to get a lot more vocal about resources. Look, man, I never do this, but let me read a quote. In the middle of the Korean War, 5th Air Force Commander, Major General Earl Partridge explained, "One of my biggest failings has been to take a look at the chips and say, how can I best accomplish my mission with what I have? What I should have done was to sit back and scream for more and get what we needed to fight a war and accomplish our mission. And I'm going to be direct. We need to take General Partridge's advice. When I hear air and space leaders talking these days and testifying on the Hill and doing media engagements, I hear a lot of the former. What can I do with what I've got? When in fact, it is time, given what's at stake and the operational requirements, to speak to how we can best net what the nation needs most effectively and efficiently through air and space power and make the case for that. I know the top line budget is not going to go up, but we can shift within the DoD budget. And I think it's time to really think about that. I mean, let's not forget, General Deptula brings it up a lot, but he's right. You look at the last 20 years, the Army got $1 trillion more than the Department of Air Force. And it is time for rebalance. We simply cannot reset the force for what we need, have the capacity we need, and handle things like two legs of the triad and all that without some smart resetting here. The Air Force was asked to take risk for 3 decades since the end of the Cold War. It is time for a rebalance. And you cannot have joint power without air power and space power. And so it is time to reinvest in those services. And it's time for leaders to make that case. So that's it, man. Paper's online if folks want to read it on our website. And I just bottom line, I think Korea offers us a lot more than flying stories over MGAllie. And that's why I was really excited to dig into this. And so on that note, I'll bring up another quote here, breaking my rule twice here on this episode.
I love it.
But this one is from General William Momeyer, who served in World War II, Korea, and commanded in Vietnam. And he really sums up a lot of how I feel about this history. And he said, "We mustn't rely entirely upon history for yesterday's ideas to fight tomorrow's wars, after all. But I hope our airmen won't pay the price in combat for what some of us have already purchased."
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, I won't do a quote, but I'll paraphrase Colonel John Boyd when he said, you know, be or do, right? So it's time for some folks, it sounds like, to stand up and not worry about their next rank and fight for what they know their airmen need.
Yep, too true.
Well, Doug, thanks so much for being here. We always learn so much from you and really appreciate your time from your busy schedule.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in today. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, and this year, we're headed out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. Also, leave us a comment to let us know what you think about our podcast and let us know areas you think we should explore further. Please visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to read the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check 6.